Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is John Pavley, Senior Vice President of Software Engineering at Viacom. Because I was working with startups for a while when I was in California, and these conventions were always kind of on the cards. It's like you go there and meet X, Y, and Z people, but I always felt that you had to be like really strategic, because it was very easy to kind of lose the reason why you were there from like a business perspective. And I always did like such a poor job at them. But then I would always hear from so many people that they were really valuable for startups and meeting and networking people. But I never really got that from them. What were your sort of experiences from them?
Well, definitely networking, I think, is really important. But it can be difficult to network these days, especially because everybody has their entourage. They also have their laptop. They have their mobile phone. So nobody's kind of really sitting by themselves and, or going to groups to meet other people unless they have a very clear agenda, right? So those really great accidental meetings where you run into somebody in the hallway because you're getting coffee together have become harder and harder to create. And I think that's actually something that the industry needs to look at because we're becoming very siloed. But, I go primarily because I want to look at the technology. I want to understand not only what's going on the inside, what's being presented to me, maybe when a salesperson comes and brings the CTO, but what are they saying to the other folks attending the show? And what are they saying to consumers? What are the marketing messages on the outside as well as, the inside information that, we will get as well? Because you have to be careful that you don't live in a bubble. And people love to create a bubble customized just for you, and sales decks that are customized just for you, newsletters that are customized just for you. So I really like to understand from different points of view what a technology looks like, what an application or system, what kind of solutions does it bring to mind to different sorts of people from different backgrounds, different industries.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think that you hit the nail on the head for me when you were talking about getting, those outside influences and getting outside of that bubble. It's so, so important to do that. We've definitely been big advocates of kind of corresponding that message on this show where, if you're not thinking outside the bubble, that tends to be where mistakes happen, is when you're relying on internal information to make decisions, essentially, isn't it? So getting in those environments where it's unbiased and you're having that external feedback is absolutely paramount, especially when it comes to strategy and decision making. So yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And if these conventions are serve the purpose for that, then I think that's more power to them. I think I've just always struggled with how to kind of approach them because they always seem so kind of overwhelming, especially with some of the size of the ones that we were just talking about in, CES in Vegas and stuff. So I think there's like a strategy involved with going to these type of things to get out of it what you really desire.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You have to have a strategy. These are big shows. I also attend NAB, which is also in Las Vegas, and the IBC, which is in Amsterdam. These are giant shows aimed at the television industry, and you really have to go in and understand what are you looking for, what unique qualities that each of these different shows give you, because you don't want to end up talking to the same people. And I tend to divide things up by the classic, what are the advances in hardware? What are the advances in cloud services? What are the advances in software? And then also, who's really out there shaking things up? Who seems to have a mission and a plan? Who's the Elon Musk of, cable or broadcast or software development or tools, right? So, because it's really hard to predict the winners and losers, and you want to be, cautious with your investment, of time, of money, of relationships. But at the same time, if you're totally cautious, then you're not going to spot that person, place, or thing that is going to radically change things. And you just wake up one day, and there's Facebook, or there's Snapchat, or there's Instagram. In fact, I was just watching CNBC this morning, and they're talking about how Snapchat seems to be heading down Twitter's territory. And it's really interesting because, 6 months ago, that was a completely different story. And, we don't really know what's happening with Snapchat. And it's important for us to know because Snapchat is engaging with our customers. And we need to understand, how we can respond to that, how we can bake that into our strategy. But if Snapchat is, losing market share and, we've placed some bets there, then we need to understand that. And the way to do it isn't to ask Snapchat. They'll tell you how wonderful everything is. But to get outside of that bubble, understand what our users are doing, but also understand the messages that they're hearing and the technology that they're interested in.
It's, I have my thoughts on Snapchat. I've always kind of been a little bit bearish on that platform personally, but I won't go into that. It's interesting that you, you kind of talk about these things from this perspective. You've held, engineering and VP of engineering roles, CTO type roles for a while now. That is just a really good kind of macroeconomic understanding of kind of your industry. And I suppose the first thing that comes to mind for me are how it's necessary to have that awareness as someone who is a VP of engineering or CTO type role, and how much of a shift that is from a hands-on kind of on the tools, for lack of a better term, role, to going into those kind of higher level roles where you have to start having that kind of macro perspective on things. I suppose the first thing is, do you remember kind of the transition where you had to start thinking like that? Or was it kind of just more of a natural transition for yourself?
Yeah, when I think back in the past and my evolution and how I think about software engineering in relation to other activities, what I found is that when I started in my career, I was just interested in writing software, coding, developing, cool stuff, and really trying to see what can I make the computer do. But I learned very quickly poignantly when I was at Apple Computer, we were working on a really cool functionality. It was called Compound Documents, and we were working on this project called OpenDoc, and we were going to change the software, the application software that does word processing and spreadsheets and databases. This is back in the days when there was no cloud, so everything was in your computer, and we were going to turn it into interoperable components that are dynamic. And I just fell in love with this OpenDoc, and I worked on it for about a year and a half. I have a couple patents with other engineers in this area. And then Microsoft came along with what they called Olay at the time, Object Linking and Embedding, and later it became ActiveX. But the interesting thing is that the technology, we felt, rightly or wrongly, at Apple that we had superior technology, but Microsoft back then, especially in the 90s, did a much better job of understanding what the customer wanted. The customer didn't want this component-based system. The customer wanted just simplicity in moving text that they copied from one app into another. And, you know, that was, it was very difficult because we thought we had superior technology, but what we didn't have is an understanding of how the business world works as software engineers. And so now, you know, since that time, I have learned that I have to keep my eye not only on the technical problem at hand, but the business problem as well. And, you know, just, it's not my job to figure out what the business is. It's not my job to, you know, meet with the customers and chat with them, but I've learned to ask questions and, you know, sort of take that software engineer's mind and bring it to the business problem. And what I found is that it's a real collaboration because software is very fluid. Software can do almost anything you want, except usually, you know, not the one thing that you want because that's too hard. And so by having that real collaboration, by like learning the vocabulary of the business and then taking software concepts with that, we can find solutions that actually meet the needs of the real people out there without having to compromise too much and figuring out what are the right things to do and what are the things that just don't make sense. So over the years, I've really evolved since my Apple days, and I feel like I got kind of an MBA at Apple and the startups I was at and the companies I've been at because, you know, I don't have that piece of paper, but what I have is like, you know, a couple decades in the business watching really good ideas fail, bad ideas succeed, and then, you know, ultimately bad ideas, like, you know, if you have a great understanding of your customer, but at the core, your software is in bad shape and, you know, has a lot of tech debt and isn't really suited for the job, then you sort of have a hollow shell and eventually it collapses. And we've seen this, for example, with Windows, where, you know, Windows was this really strong, and it still is. It's the majority of operating systems out there are Windows operating systems running on laptops and desktops. But we also see all these security issues. We also see, you know, the vulnerabilities. And, you know, I love Microsoft. I think they're a great company. I have mad respect for them. But, and I believe they are embarking on bringing, you know, better software engineering concepts into their core because, you know, I think they're really good, or they have been good at the past, of meeting the needs of the user and the business user. You know, I have a Surface Book Pro that I love. It's, you know, it's a great tablet slash laptop. But, you know, Windows 10 worries me. I'm worried about security in a way that I'm not worried with Linux systems. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what Microsoft's going to do about that. But, you know, the core heart of Unix and Linux and now Mac OS X is that it's based on open source software where we're pretty clear, you know, what's going on in that code. You know, we as engineers can look at that, and there's this principle of open source that, you know, you have 1,000 eyes on that code as opposed to, you know, a handful. And maybe that's something that Microsoft needs to continue to embrace. They're already embracing it, but, you know, at the end of the day, code that isn't available publicly from in an open source model is ironically code that is less trustworthy than code that is, you know, tightly held private, right? And that only a handful of people can see, because no engineer is perfect. Nobody can create the perfect system. Engineering is actually a team sport.
Right. Interesting. Very interesting. And I wanted to ask you a little bit as well, maybe not too far off line here, but you know, I noted that kind of one of the big interests for you at the moment is functional programming. I'm just interested to kind of hear a little bit, I suppose, for the layman's like me, a little bit more about kind of functional programming and why you're so into it at the moment. And, you know, if you have kind of any kind of real-time examples of what this could potentially benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a revolution that's been ongoing for the last 10 years or longer, slowly picking up speed. Functional programming at its heart is to treat functions as first-class citizens, first-class objects. And you know, if you know a little bit about programming, you might know that you have variables, and you can that variable is like a shoebox, and you can put a number in there. And in many programming languages, you can put any kind of thing in that shoebox. You could put a number, some text, you could put another object, but you couldn't put a function. And you know, there's so much more you can do with functional programming, because when you can treat a function as a variable, you can then create a little machine that can chew through any problem that you have, and it allows you to write less code, and your code becomes easier to reason about. So, you know, one of the things we do as software engineers is we are building these machines. I really think of them as, you know, machines in your mind. And they're going to process data. They're going to respond to a request. They're going to draw something on the screen. And these machines have state. And the state can get very complicated, right? You know, whether you're writing a game or a video player or a social media app, there's, you know, thousands, maybe even millions of bits of state, especially if it's multi-user. And so in the traditional object-oriented programming or procedural programming or even declarative programming, you're trying all different ways to model the world that's, you know, inside your machine. And you do that by modeling the world that's outside your machine. There's a user out there, and the user has a name and an ID and a password. And so you have inside your little software machine, you have bits of state, and you need to coherently keep that user together and protect that user's information from functions or classes or objects that shouldn't know anything about it. So functional programming is a style, a way of being very, very clear about how you can use state and what kind of objects can operate on state. And you know, at its core, a function is a great little state machine. And with functional programming languages, which include JavaScript and Apple's new language Swift and Kotlin, which is a new, not that new, but relatively newer language for Android. And then there's sort of the famous original functional programming language, which is Lisp. And then you have Haskell and Erlang, and even Java, good old Java and .NET are beginning to get into functional programming with F Sharp on the .NET side and Scala on the Java side, which is you know, these are sort of interoperable in their environment, so you can mix functional and non-functional. But it's from a software engineering point of view, I see functional programming as just taking good basic coding ideas and enforcing them in the language. And you know, I could go into great detail, but the important thing from, I think, the non-software engineer perspective is that as software becomes more important, as it starts driving our cars, as it starts managing our homes, as it starts, you know, ordering food for us automatically based on what's in our refrigerator, you want to have safe software, reliable software. And also, you want to write as little software as possible. You know, the more code you write, the more bugs you have. And functional programming is very expressive and very, very succinct.
I like it. I like it. And you know, the amount of different like coding languages that you just kind of listed off there that are getting involved in functional programming, it kind of gets me on nicely against my next point that I know you're quite passionate about, and I actually am also pretty passionate about this myself, is you know, getting young people into coding at an early age. You know, we'll get into kind of where the responsibilities lie with regards to that. But first and foremost, like you know, because of the role that software and development is going to play in our everyday lives more and more. You know, the importance of having the next generation who actually understands what's going on is absolutely paramount. I believe that we're kind of at a strange point of infliction at the moment, where we have so many people using operating systems and computers that have no idea how it's actually working. They're using websites every single day, but they have absolutely no idea how anything's working. I think this is quite a strange phenomenon because, you know, beforehand, you know, you look at the basics of, like, when cars were kind of invented, people would get the car, but they'd kind of have a really, a relatively high level understanding of kind of the mechanics behind it. And we have, like, a whole generation now that really doesn't have a strong understanding about what's actually going on and what they're using on a day-to-day basis. And I think the obvious thing to point to is, like, a safety security risk. But I think this next generation, they won't have that problem. But they could, if we're not careful enough and don't give them enough opportunities to learn how to code at a young age. So, you know, I definitely want to kind of talk about that a little bit, about kind of the importance of that, and, you know, kind of how, any thoughts on kind of how you would support, you know, young people learning how to code?
Sure. And there's many different ways I'm doing that right now. But to give you a little background on why this is so important to me, I really feel that software made me who I am. It changed my life incredibly dramatically. I didn't come from a wealthy family. I didn't come from circumstances where, you know, I had the luxury to go to school and just learn. I had to pay my own way, and I was heading down a different course, let's call it the liberal arts course. And I think if I had continued down that road, you know, my life would have been really difficult. If you look today at people who aren't in the technology field, it's a very uncertain time. And we felt that all the way back in the 70s. When I was a kid, I ran across a book called Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. By today's standard, Future Shock doesn't even exist. But back then, you did what your grandfather did. You did what your father did. You did what your mother did, right? There wasn't as much advancement in technology at this accelerating pace. But even in the 70s and the 60s, people were beginning to see that you weren't going to end up doing what your parents did. You were going to have to find some new way to contribute to society. You weren't going to be a farmer or a miner or a manufacturer. And, I had no clue other than the world had enough artists and writers and poets already. That was not a field where, you know, maybe you could find personal fulfillment, but, you know, becoming successful was like winning the lottery. And then I fell in love with the Macintosh computer. You know, I'd played around with basic programming, with the computers like the Ataris and the Commodores, even the original Apple. But when I saw the power of what this first Macintosh computer could do, I just knew I had to learn how to program it. And I did without, there was no internet. There was no continuing education classes. There was no MOOCs that would teach me this. And, I couldn't really, not only couldn't I afford to go to, a school like MIT or something like that, they weren't teaching Macintosh software development back then. And, it was tough. It took me a long time. It took me probably years to master it, whereas today you can just go to Stack Overflow, or you can go to Udemy, or you can go to a coding camp and people will help you with that process and you can look up the information. But I was just so obsessed that I stuck with it and eventually ended up in technology, working for Apple, developing software, managing software, managing engineers. And I really give all that credit to software development. And, You know, I see kids today in the same situation that I was in, only worse. You know, there's less manufacturing jobs. There's more, you know, sort of, you know, service jobs, jobs where there's not a lot of fulfillment. The other day I was with my daughter who, you know, she's an adult, a young adult, and we went to Starbucks and we were just looking at the baristas and they didn't look very happy. You know, they weren't smiling, happy people. They looked like a couple of very overworked young people, you know, who were almost like machines manufacturing Frappuccinos. And I felt kind of bad. I felt at that point, I'm like, why did I order a strawberry cream Frappuccino? I feel terrible now. So what we know is happening from shows like, you know, CES, you know, we know that automation is coming. I at CES this year, I saw an automated barista, that a robot basically that builds a Frappuccino for you. You know, soon we'll have 3D printers that can make sandwiches. But what we are in short supply of, what we need desperately, are software engineers. And we need software engineers who are the sort of hardcore functional programming back-end coders who, you know, make Google faster in search. And we need software engineers who build delightful user experiences and are almost more like designers who code. But we need that whole spectrum. And I think for whatever reason, to this day, software engineering is still sort of like this boring but important thing. And coding is seen as not as much fun as playing a game, but many of the same skills are utilized. And if you're going to sit in front of a screen all day to get high score on your video game, why can't you take, you know, the pattern matching, the attention to detail, the focus on, you know, abstract concepts and puzzle solving and bring that to coding. So that is sort of my thesis. You know, it worked for me. It's changed my life. It's made me, in a way, I think coding makes you powerful. You know, it's a real world superpower. When you can go up to a machine, you can log on to it and you can fix something, you can create something, you can solve something. It feels great. It feels like you're one of those Marvel superheroes, in at least in the virtual world. But how do we get kids to pay attention to that? How do we change their perception of what coding is?
Well, I mean, I personally think that it has come a long way. I think that it is getting a little bit more sexy, which I think is what it needs. It does need to be a little bit more glamorized. You know, it needs to be featured a little bit more in films, in TV, whatever kind of the outlets are. It needs to be made fashionable to do. And I think that we have made a lot of strides, certainly from my perspective. It feels a little bit more that way, a little bit more fashionable to code. And I think that that will build momentum. And I think that eventually we will get there. But I also think that the education and schools have a huge responsibility here as well, to kind of introduce it to the curriculum at a much younger age. It's still not a part of the curriculum early enough. I mean, I know they have it in universities and stuff, but, you know, they need to be teaching it to kids at a young age, or at least introducing it to them at a young age. And I think that, like, a lot of the responsibility is really kind of in education, to kind of introduce it to them. And it needs to feel like, you know, like what sports would feel like, what PE would feel like. It's like one of the, when it was PE time, everyone's excited, everyone's kind of geared up for that sort of thing. It needs to have that same kind of aura around it. You know, people are going to go and build something that it needs to have that feel to it. And I think that's all about how you kind of depict it in the media, the news outlets, and I think depict it in the schools as well. I think they're the main things. And I personally think that when it builds the momentum and it builds up that kind of sexier aura around it, in the public eye, it'll filter down, and that's what will kind of motivate kids. And, you know, stuff like the Zuckerbergs of the world and Sean Parkers and whoever else who's kind of made a ton of money, I think that, that does help. I think that does make people think, wow, maybe that's something that I should get involved in. So I think we're getting there slowly but surely, but it's definitely been a slow road, and as you say, we're still screaming out for software engineers, so we're nowhere near there yet.
I think you're absolutely right in everything that you said. We at Viacom support Girls Who Code as just one of the initiatives that we've done. And Girls Who Code brings in high school girls, and then we host them for a few weeks in the summer. And Girls Who Code supplies the main teacher, but then our engineers come in, both male and female, to mentor. And the job there is to, I'm a little nervous about words like glamorize because, I don't want it to be like turned into, I don't know, a gender thing. And sometimes glamour is associated with women. Men can be glamorous too, by the way. That's absolutely fine. And the important thing is that we need the role models there. So the female engineers and engineering managers on our team at Viacom are great role models because they're real women. They have, struggled a bit in a male-dominated field, maybe even more than a bit. And so they're not only great engineers, but they're very inspirational stories of how they've overcome the obstacles. And, I was talking with some of my engineers the other day. We have sort of a online forum, and I said, "Who are your software heroes?" And, one of my software heroes is Bill Atkinson, who he wrote QuickDraw and HyperCard, two of my favorite, software things from the 90s. And, other people chimed in, but there wasn't a single female engineer named. And there are great women in software engineering, like Grace Hopper, and going all the way back, probably the first programmer was Ada Lovelace. But right now it's hard for even contemporary software developers to just rattle off, great female role models. And I think that's the big problem for what, I don't know how it happened, but software engineering has become a male thing, sort of like football. And women are, project managers and product managers and business, even heads of business units. But the people who write the code somehow have become very male dominated. And we need to change that. And it does start very early with education. I'm not sure what exactly needs to change, and that's why I'm looking at a lot of different ideas, a lot of different techniques. Apple has this great software platform called Playgrounds, and you were speaking earlier about bringing software engineering earlier into the curriculum, maybe making it more of a game, making it more exciting and interesting. I would go farther. I would bring it in as early as possible, and instead of giving kids a pen and paper or pencil and paper to solve math problems, to solve word problems, teach them how to use the computer to do that for them, because that's the thing. The computer enhances and extends our abilities, and why not focus on getting people comfortable with programming the computer at a very young age to solve the problems for them, because it's a different world now. It's not like the computers are going to go away and we need to pick up the abacus again.
I totally agree, and it's a really interesting one to actually sit there and think about, is like why things become female or male dominated. There has to be some kind of propaganda associated with that. It's an interesting thought, and one that I'm not going to be able to unlock here on the show, but it's fascinating to actually think why they do have a male female bias, isn't it? Whether it's the actual role itself, that's I have no idea, but yeah, I'm all in support of that. And I noticed the campaign, was it Code org. I think they did quite a big campaign, didn't they?
A while
ago, and that was quite good. They had, I think, models and a few other like female rock star like CEOs that kind of featured in that. And I thought that was a good job. And they had athletes and people like that in that campaign as well. But you don't really see much of it. Definitely not enough kind of promotional material behind just getting people involved. Code.org's the only one that really sticks in my mind, actually. But
yeah, code.org was sort of a government/industry initiative. I think that it's done a lot of good and it's very inspirational. But even there, it's sort of a focusing on almost like on the nuts and bolts of learning to code. But what we also need to focus on are the bigger concepts, the software engineering concepts that, enable us to figure out what kind of code to write.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think it's it goes deeper than that, doesn't it, than just kind of an introductory, it doesn't give it justice, does it? I think it's, someone was saying to me the other day, it's like, when you're kind of learning to code in these coding schools, they are like beneficial, but you almost don't know what you're not supposed to know after those like coding schools. So it does go kind of a little bit further than that. But yeah, I think that we have to start somewhere. And maybe the introduction is great, but then the continued support as kind of a motivator needs to be there as well to keep people engaged and wanting to do it for kind of a long period of time. Not everyone's going to be obviously as kind of motivated as you were to continue with it, because at the end of the day, when kids are getting involved in things, there's so many other options and opportunities that they could be doing. We have to really kind of make sure that it's easily accessible to them, and I think that's it. It's the ease of access to learning new things is how you kind of generate results.
Yeah, that might have been an advantage for me back in the late 80s and early 90s. The computers that came along didn't do much. They didn't have many applications. We didn't have the internet. So when you got a computer, especially in the 80s, you had to learn to write software, or it just sat there and just looked cool. Like, it didn't do anything. I remember spending many hours, just trying to figure out, how do I make this computer work? Like, what code do I write to show something on the screen or play a sound or manage numbers? One of the first software programs that I'm proud of that I wrote was actually an advertising system for a art store. I was working as a clerk at this art store, and I just on my own, I said to the owner, I said, "Oh, you have signs in the window. What if I could take this TI-99/4A computer and a monitor and automate the signs so that, they can scroll and it's kind of animated and a little more interesting. Maybe it'll attract some customers." So it wasn't much software as compared to today, but it was like a little advertising marquee, and I wrote it out in TI Basic, and I had to hand code all the graphics in as hexadecimal numbers, and that taught me a lot of stuff. It taught me about binary, it taught me about hexadecimal, it taught me about how this little 16-bit computer stored data and displayed it on the screen, which I didn't know at the time, but that was like one of the foundations of my computer science education. So then when I'd come to a much more sophisticated computer like the Apple Macintosh, I already kind of knew the fundamentals from writing software on these toy computers, because it was the same principle. What's great about computer science is whether you're talking about something in the cloud or something in your, like a phone in your hand, or you're talking about a quantum computer, there are certain fundamentals that are shared among all of those systems. And so if you understand the fundamentals, right? So if coding camps focus on here's how to code JavaScript and all you learn is how to code JavaScript, you don't really have much of a skill. But if they focus on here's the underlying concepts of data structures and algorithms, then you have a skill that where you can work with any language in any paradigm.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. I'm conscious of time here, John. I know you're on holiday as well, on vacation, so won't keep you for too much longer. But one kind of thing I noticed on your LinkedIn was the when you were at LimeWire and then you kind of moved over to Spotify. That just a fan of kind of that kind of disruptive move that obviously I think. The whole kind of that's peer-to-peer sharing on we all kind of was really Napster based, I would assume that's how it all kind of started, and then along came LimeWire and stuff like that. Just as a fan, how cool of a time was it to be a part of LimeWire and then obviously moving over to Spotify?
It was very exciting. It was sort of, I would say, it was the final 2 years of LimeWire. And it was the beginning of streaming. And what's great about streaming is it solves a problem for both the user and the industry. Although there's a lot of controversy and people might disagree. But from my perspective, the reason that P2P sharing became so popular was not because people want to be pirates, not because they want to steal other people's creative work, but because they wanted access. And the way that, the pre-internet distribution model was set up is that, accessing music, even if you had the money to pay for it, accessing content could be very difficult. Something could be out of print. It could be out of license. To this day, you can't listen to a lot of King Crimson through legal streaming systems like iTunes or Spotify or Google Play, because there's these licensing disagreements that is keeping that work offline. And so you have to, what I do is I hunt for it at record shops and I still have a CD collection because I'm a King Crimson Robert Fripp fan. And, I have to actually work hard to find that music. The streaming came in and solve the access problem. And now what we have to do is solve the cost model, because the cost per stream doesn't really bring the kind of revenue to the artist that it did when you bought a CD or an LP. So I think that's sort of the next thing that we're going to do is, or the industry, I'm going to say we, because I'm not in that industry anymore, but the next thing that they're working on right now is figuring out how to change the model so that the revenue is going in the right place, and that the consumers, because just listening to stream is one way to support an artist, but maybe there are other ways to support an artist, e-commerce or Kickstarter, crowdsourcing. I think there's going to be a lot of excitement and experimentation going on right now about that, because it's not, we've solved sort of the access problem, but if the artists don't have money, they're not going to actually be able to remain artists, and music might become more of a part-time job.
I think there's obviously a huge amount of debate around the topic. I think that the beauty of like the peer-to-peer and streaming is that it's the artists that might not be kind of in the top 100 charts, but are putting out a lot of music and working hard. It gives them an opportunity for more people to hear them through the means of streaming and search than they would have had the opportunity to do before, where you would be relying on kind of the record labels and the and all the confines of that kind of world and being yes or no'd by someone, right? So I think that it's really a nice democratic way of kind of people sharing their music and sharing their work. it doesn't necessarily mean that it should be free, but you know, a lot of content, even outside of music, is free at the moment, and you know, people have to be creative on how they monetize. So I think that there's pros and cons. I think the guys at the top end will probably complain because they used to be able to make, you know, millions from selling records and record shops, but it's the people in the middle ground who have the opportunity to share music to a bigger audience now than they otherwise would have ever had. So I think it's an interesting space to be in, that's for sure. And I hope they work it out, but I'm kind of with you. I think it's been a very positive thing, this opportunity for people to have a shot and at least give everyone kind of a platform to share their work on, and that's what the internet brought, and I think that's what, you know, it's kind of evolved into, and it's very much purposed for. And now I think they're taking to the next level, aren't they, with stuff like blockchain and that, but I don't think we have enough time to go into that either. But that's a fascinating one as well, and decentralization. But yeah, I mean, wow, what an interesting time to have been at LimeWire. Very jealous of that that situation, and a lot of the projects that you've taken on have been particularly compelling, and I'm sure, you know, having a variety of projects that you've worked on that obviously have been very successful and stuff, you know, it's probably given you such great perspective, and I'm sure that it's been a process of constantly kind of learning things, whether it be technical or leadership style, whatever the case may be. You know, I think just closing thoughts for me, you know, I think that the importance of wherever you go, whatever project you decide to work on, whatever move you decide to make, I think for me, to encourage people who are listening, it's all about taking on something where you're actually going to learn something. And I think if you kind of hold that true, I think you'll get to the right place eventually.
I totally agree. I think when I look back, you know, I've been in the industry a while. I used to be the youngest guy in the room when I started out, and now I'm one of the old guys, right? And what I see is that the consistent thread is that I just become fascinated with understanding. I want to open up the box, the black box, and look inside and understand how the magic works. And, you know, one of my favorite science fiction authors, Arthur C. Clarke, famously observed that any sufficiently advanced technology is magical, right? You know, there's a lot of people out there, unfortunately, who don't understand how these computer systems work, and so they become these sort of magical beasts, you know, right up there with unicorns and Patronuses. There's not that intuitive understanding that a software engineer would have of how something works, and so when it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, you know, you just throw up your hands. So many times people will just say to me, I can't get my computer to work. Can you help me? And then in 2 minutes or 2 seconds even, I've changed the setting or restarted it or moved something. And they're like, oh, now it works. But I didn't do anything magical. And I think that's what we need. It's like the 21st century survival skill is a deep curiosity to open up the box and look inside and satisfy yourself that you understand how it works. You don't have to be a great programmer. You don't have to invent the internet, but you have to, whether in regards of what business you're in, what you're doing, you know, even if you feel like I hate computers, I don't want to touch them, you need to understand how they work. And that's what's done it for me, is by understanding how software and hardware work together. I feel like it's opened up so many doors.
Great point to finish on. John, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's great speaking with you, Andy.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.